Laudato Jesus Christus. This is the English program of Vatican Radio.
Hello, welcome to today's broadcast. I'm Veronica Scaresbrick, and I'll be with you for the next half hour. In a few moments, I'll be taking an in-depth look at Pope Benedict's encyclical, Spes Salvi. I'll be marking the feast day of Our Lady of Loreto and bringing you musical notes to mark the third Sunday in Advent. Well, thanks so much for joining me once again. As I said a moment ago, we begin today by taking a closer look at Pope Benedict XVI's encyclical focusing on hope by the Latin title of Spes Salvi. So be sure to stay tuned as we join renowned author and theologian, Jesuit, Father Gerald O. Collins. The Pope's first encyclical was on love, his second one is on hope. The subject is in continuity, but perhaps the style is very different. Would you agree?
Well, this second encyclical is much more peppered with quotations from a whole variety of authors, from the Russian novelist Dostoevsky and from some great Jewish-German thinkers, Horkheimer and Adorno. It's a much richer encyclical from a scholarly point of view, and there's a very detailed section about the New Testament. The Pope deals with the letter to the Hebrews in great detail. So it's a more rounded, fuller, scholarly encyclical. It's also coming out of a pastor's concern. It's a world in which a lot of people are finding it very hard to exercise any kind of hope, and hope has been a neglected theme. An Anglican bishop the other day remarked that to me, how pleased he was with the encyclical, that it's addressing a theme that's so central and so often neglected.
Why do you say neglected? Because there hasn't been an encyclical before on hope ever?
Well, back in the 1960s and 1970s, there was a lot of attention to hope. Vatican II, its last and greatest document, Gaudium et Spes, Joy and Hope, was addressing the theme of hope. But then for a number of years, there's been little attention paid to it. Maybe the world's got so busier and there've been so many challenges coming up. Whatever the reasons, I think there's been a shift away from that to other themes. So I was quite glad to see the Pope refocus on the centrality of Christian hope, which is, I mean, if God is not our hope, we're really in deep trouble.
You mentioned the 1960s and Vatican II, yet in this encyclical, Pope Benedict never mentions Vatican II.
Well, in the 1960s, you had the conflict with, dialogue with Marxism. That went on into the 70s and 80s, but was particularly strong in the 1960s. How do we live in the world with this great ideology that's opposed to us and that's causing so much pain and cruelty and injustice? Well, with the collapse of European communism, that kind of dialogue was more or less definitively disappeared. So in the 60s, I think the Cold War had a role in encouraging attention to the theme of hope.
Would you agree that in this document, once again, Pope Benedict characteristically links pastoral and cultural dimensions?
It's very cultural, it's pastoral, it's clearly addressed more towards people in the Western world. I mean, people who are hoping to get a job and people are hoping to get married and find a lasting, happy partnership and so on. But it isn't addressed quite so much to people who are living in refugee camps who hope that the militia doesn't come along and kidnap and rape more women. It's not addressing that world. It's addressing a world of high culture, the North Atlantic world, if you like.
But there's also a very practical side to the document. No prayer, action and suffering.
It raises some very interesting points about suffering, that judging societies by what they do about the people who are suffering within that society. And I think many societies in the West, for example, can turn their faces away from suffering. And I found that something new, that challenge to assess a society by the way in which it has compassion, active compassion and hope for those who are suffering in all kinds of ways.
Pope Benedict focuses on the Last Judgment at one point in the encyclical.
Oh, yeah.
No. Why does he do that while speaking of hope?
I think he wants to deal with the Last Judgment to show that it's a very hopeful mystery. It's not a terrifying mystery about, you know, will God reject me finally? But it's a mystery, a hope that the victims will be vindicated. The world's history is full of so many injustices, and individual lives are full of injustices, and the Last Judgment means that God will not ignore all that, but set that right, that the victims will be justified and the perpetrators, that the evil they've done will be seen to be just that evil. So I think, looking at it in Pope Benedict's way, the Last Judgment is a very hopeful mystery. He has that lovely image about leaving church in the medieval period, when many churches had a picture of the Last Judgment as over the West Wall, and people would go out to their daily lives thinking, yes, I've got to live responsibly, and because, you know, God will have the last word, that justice will be done. And the Last Judgment is not a mystery of horror and fear or terror, as in, say, Michelangelo's representation of the Sistine Chapel, but it's a mystery of confidence in our God, who will see that justice is done.
You mentioned an image just a moment ago. There are quite a few images. Among them, the Pope, for example, speaks of Christ as a true philosopher, and he speaks about the sarcophagus with Christ depicted as a philosopher.
Pope brings in some great images from the early church. That one's quite familiar, that Christ is as the young divine shepherd rescuing his sheep at a time of persecution. But he also brings in Christ as the true philosopher, the one who is wisdom itself, that to he is the way. His plan of action is the wise way to live. So I was glad to see him bringing in those two images. And he also adds in a few of his own images, like eternal life being plunged into the ocean of infinite love. The Pope has an eye for some helpful ancient images, as well as creating some of his own.
You mentioned just earlier on that this encyclical is directed more to people in the Western world. It is very philosophical, isn't it?
Yes, it's philosophical in the sense of it's drawing on the great German philosopher Immanuel Kant. The Pope has two very telling quotations from Kant. Towards the end of the 18th century, the French Revolution happens, and the enlightened philosophers of the time, like Kant, thought, hooray, you know, finally freedom and progress, and things turned violent and terror broke out. And a couple of years later, Kant writes a very sober essay on violence, and this is no way to live, this is Antichrist. I found that a very interesting use of Kant. So the Pope appeals to him, and also he goes right back to Plato, a very interesting picture of a kind of Last Judgment from one of the dialogues of Plato. So it is Western in that sense, using Plato at the very beginning of Western philosophy and Kant much later. And he's also got a language that has been used in British analytic philosophy about informative and performative judgments, that there are some statements which inform and others that encourage us to perform certain things. It's the language of some analytic philosophers, and it was interesting to see the Pope picking up that language, that Christian hope, yes, it informs us about things, but it's also calling upon us to perform in a new way.
What struck you most about this encyclical at a personal level? I mean, you're a theologian.
Well, I was very struck by the prayer to Mary at the end, that we'd had a number of prayers, addresses to the Blessed Virgin Mary at the end of major writings by John Paul II, but here Pope Benedict XVI finishes his encyclical with a very touching, lovely prayer to the Blessed Virgin Mary. And what he has there is a prayer that's at least as good as those of his predecessors, maybe even better. But I was very touched. I hadn't anticipated that. I thought, well, that's something we had from the previous Pope, but Pope Benedict wants to bring out how the Blessed Virgin Mary is a great reality and symbol of hope, the star of hope, to quote that early image of her.
You talk about the star of hope. There's another passage in the encyclical Well, the Pope uses the image of the Magi following the star.
He uses the star, yes, when he's dealing with one of the early church fathers who has a lovely thing about the Magi, that up till the time of Christ we'd had, well, astrology, if you like, worship of stars or obedience towards the elemental things in the universe, and now with the coming of Christ, he is the morning star that has dawned, and things have fallen into place. And I think the Pope uses that very nicely to bring out the way in which, yes, the world is ruled by natural laws, by evolution, but the last word belongs to God. It's all under the governance of the loving God in whom we can pin our hopes.
Perhaps you can mention something about how the Pope deals with freedom.
There's a long section about freedom and reason, and he begins with Francis Bacon. Benedict looks back to that English thinker, statesman Francis Bacon, who encouraged very much the growth of scientific method. And Bacon thought using our reason freely, we would be able to discover things and order our world better, and a new Jerusalem would come in this world. And the Holy Father has some sobering, helpful comments there that, yes, science has got its place to play, and we have incremental knowledge. We know more. Technology has leapt ahead with leaps and bounds, but there's a limit to that, that it doesn't answer the deep questions of life. I mean, who am I? Where am I going? What is there to hope for? So, yes, by all means, let's have better technology and scientific method, but let's have it at the service of real human living. So I found that section on progress very helpful, going back to somebody who stood there at the beginning of it all, Francis Bacon, with his encouragement of the scientific method. Bacon also thought of, imagined future discoveries that were still way off in the future, like aircraft and submarines. He had a very fertile imagination and great hopes as to what progress could bring. The Pope also quotes there a sobering thing from Theodore Adorno, the German Jewish thinker, that what is progress? Is it moving from the sling to the atom bomb? And Pope doesn't totally agree with that, but he says it's certainly a remark that brings out the ambiguity of scientific progress, that we can use it for good or for evil.
And a big thank you there to Jesuit Father Gerald O'Collins, renowned author and theologian. And moving on in the programme, I've chosen to mark the feast day of Our Lady of Loreto, which falls on the 10th of December. I do this with a person whose voice is familiar to our regular listeners. She's Professor of Fine Arts, Breda Ennis, and she spoke to my colleague, Lydia O'Kane, earlier in the week. Let's listen.
The feast day itself is the actual date, is supposed to be the date when the house was actually brought from Nazareth to Loreto. And there are various theories as to how this happened, whether it happened with the help of the angelic, an angelic intervention. And there is also a family in the area called Angeli, which could have been involved also in the transporting of the relics of the actual house. But one thing is important. The only focus that anyone should put on that is the fact that this was the house where Mary was born. And because of that, it becomes the most prestigious and most important Marian shrine in the entire world, because it's not exactly a location where the Madonna appeared to people, but it's the little house where she actually lived. So it takes precedence over all of the other places, the other Marian shrines in the world. This was pointed out, I think, also by John Paul II, who called it the foremost shrine of international prestige devoted to the Virgin, and for several centuries, the true Marian heart of Christianity. The tradition goes back to 1294, and this was supposed to be the date when the house was brought to Loreto. So people might say, well, why Loreto and not somewhere else? Well, first and foremost, the house is brought to Italy, albeit Rome, let's say, in the sense that the country where the Vicar of Christ lives. So I think there is a distinct link between the fact that the house is in Loreto in Italy, where the Vatican is, where the successor of Peter is, and where it came from, obviously, Nazareth, where she was born. So there is a direct link to the church. You could almost say that it's a kind of protection for the Holy Father in a certain sense, the nearness of her house to him in terms of his work and his teaching as a pope and his role as the Vicar of Christ. Now, people have been questioning how this could have happened over the years. And there are various theories, and one of them is that the pieces were brought, which three of the walls of the original house, the front part was actually open onto the, out, on the outside with an open door, but the three walls were brought, the three lower parts of the wall, let's say. And then the top parts of the walls were added later by local brick and then covered in on the top. Now, and of course, the floor is supposed to be the original floor, etc. But they've been able to verify that the bricks on the lower part of the wall have a lot of graffiti, which go back to the same type of graffiti and the same kind of stone used in Nazareth, as done some archaeological research, and also research on the graffiti. And one of those graffiti pieces says, "O Jesus, Son of God." So there's a very strong link there. And probably the original house was protected from the elements by having had a church over it, or at least a house put over it, like the house covering that of the house. And it's, they say that probably in the 3rd century it was used as a place of worship in the Holy Land by the disciples of Christ. So the house itself has a lot of powerful images attached to it. The church itself became a basilica officially. It got the status of basilica in 1728. And lots of strange things happened after, because the statue of the Madonna was actually taken and brought to France by Napoleon, who ransacked that particular area and also took away a lot of things. Many things were saved by the local bishop. The house was brought to Italy in a period when Pope Celestine V renounced the papacy. There was a Vicarius Urbis, a temporary Vicarius Urbis, who took over, and his name was Bishop Salvo, who came from Recanti, which is the area near the Loreto. So this could have been a reason why that particular area was chosen to put the house. So the house, obviously, over the years became, let's say, a little house inside another little house inside another big house and inside a big structure. So it's like you're tearing away little coverings and you're getting another covering and then another covering, and then in the middle, in the end, you come across this fabulous treasure, which is the little house. And Julius II called in Bramante to do designs for this basilica here in Loreto. And it's a combination of Bramante and Sansovino. And the end result is that they were able to have this wonderful, let's say, casing, you could say decorative casing, put around the little house itself. So you have this extraordinary Renaissance, extremely beautiful, flowing casing put on the house, which is very elaborate, very, very luscious in its designs. And very beautiful in the workmanship. And then you walk in through the door to this incredible simplicity of the simple bare wall. And when I was there the last time, people just walked in total silence, and automatically your hands reach out to touch the wall. It's almost involuntary, because you just feel something extremely peaceful. It's like going into a tiny place of peace that I've never felt peace like that in any other place, to be honest. The last time I personally was there was just after the visit of Pope Benedict, and everybody was kneeling in the spot where Pope Benedict had been kneeling in prayer when he stayed in Loreto for the meeting with the young people. So people touched the wall and then immediately went to the front of the altar and knelt the spot where the Pope had knelt. also, they were making also the papal connection automatically, almost involuntarily. But when you walk into the little house, you feel like you've entered another world. You've also gone back a couple of centuries. No, not a couple of centuries, many, many, many centuries. But you can bring yourself back almost into Nazareth yourself. You feel like you've gone back to the origins of your own faith in a tangible way, even if the top parts of the walls were bricked up later. But the bottom walls are so worn and shiny from people just moving their hands across them, from sick people coming through and putting all their troubles on the wall, from other people putting their own questions on the wall. You just feel that this wall has absorbed, over the centuries, hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of thousands, maybe millions of people who brought all their troubles and their requests into that little tiny, tiny house. And you think the Madonna, she has all this weight of humanity coming into her tiny little house. It's almost like you invite 25,000 people to visit you in a one-room house, you know. It's a bit crowded. You just get the feeling that it's your turn to just pay a little visit, and then hundreds and thousands and millions of people will follow you with the same request. And you exit on the other side a completely different person inside. My first visit to Loretta was when Pope Benedict was there, and I was absolutely amazed by this house because I'd read about it, I'd seen photographs of it, etc., etc. It's nothing like being in it. But you really do feel that it is the seat of the Pope. And I think Pope Paul VI gave it the juridical status of a pontifical location. So it's directly under the auspices of the Holy Father and is very much strongly linked to his role as Pope. But the feast day itself is like going back to Mary's birth, as we're coming up now soon to, obviously, to the birth of Christ. So there's a strong link. I mean, the dates are near to each other, but it's only by accident. It just happens to be the date of 1294 on the 10th of December that these walls were brought there. And because it's so near Christmas, the Marian link goes into the Marian Holy Family feeling that you get at Christmas.
Heartfelt thanks, as always, to Professor of Fine Arts, Breda Ennis, who is currently working at the American University of Rome. And naturally, thanks to my colleague, Lydia O'Kane. Meanwhile, I'd like to end the programme on some musical notes, well, with music historian Monsignor Philip Whittemore.
For a young child, the days leading up to Christmas are full of excitement. I can remember how I used to count the days, opening a new door on my Advent calendar for each day of December as the 25th came closer and closer. When it gets to 8 days before Christmas, the church begins a kind of countdown. The readings at Mass tell us the story day by day leading up to the birth of Jesus in Bethlehem. And every day from the 17th of December right through to the 23rd, there's a beautiful plain chant antiphon to sing each day at Vespers. All seven of them contain an urgent plea. Veni, come Lord, come. Each of these antiphons begins by addressing our Lord with a title taken from the Old Testament. O Adonai, O Key of David, O Emmanuel. That's why they're called the O antiphons. The first in the series is called O Sapientia, O Wisdom, You come forth from the mouth of the Most High. You fill the universe and hold all things together in a strong yet gentle manner. O come to teach us the way of truth. These seven antiphons are full of wonderful images expressing the hope of God's people waiting for the birth of the Saviour. O Radix Jesse, O Root of Jesse, kings fall silent before you, whom the peoples acclaim. O come to deliver us. That's the antiphon for the 19th of December. And you'll notice it uses the same music as the one we had before. In fact, all the O antiphons have the same music, slightly adjusted to match the words each time. I expect you can all think of examples where the same hymn tune can be used with different sets of words. But I was fascinated to find examples of the same thing happening in plain song. All the O antiphons use the same music. And so too does a completely different antiphon, O Doctor Optime, sung at Vespers on the feast of a Doctor of the Church. Those monks who put the chant books together knew how to make the most of a good tune. But jumping ahead a few centuries, some Victorian hymn writers decided they wanted to make the most of the wonderful texts of the O antiphons. The well-known Advent hymn we heard at the start of the programme is a kind of collage of all the Old Testament images used in the O antiphons. The tune is an old French processional chant. The words express our fervent Advent hope. O come, thou key of David, O come, thou dayspring, come and cheer our spirits by thine advent here. The refrain expresses the joy that comes bursting out of us as we await the coming of the Lord.
And our thanks there go, as always, to Monsignor Philip Whitmore, a music historian who's currently working at the Vatican's Secretariat of State. And that brings us up to time. I'm Veronica Scaresbrick, and I do hope you enjoyed this broadcast. Should you wish to check out our website, the address is www.vaticanradio.org.
You've been listening to the English programme of Vatican Radio. Laudator Jesus Christus.